Hey, this is John Lee Dumas of the award-winning podcast, Entrepreneurs on Fire, and you're listening to the Excelsior Journeys with George Soroy. Prepare to ignite.
So would you say that that's kind of like the lightning bolt moment for
you? And that's
why
I taught myself how to draw, was actually the Little Mermaid, drawing stills of Ariel.
I've got better things to do tonight than die.
Sylvester jumped out of his chair and said, who the F is this?
I remember walking out of the theater with him saying, I'm going to write Halloween.
I'm rather impressed with your research. Rarely do people ask me about Children in the Corn.
It doesn't have to be perfect. Just do it. You know, throw some spaghetti against a wall. See if it sticks.
This is George Soroy saying to all of you, ever upward.
Welcome back to Excelsior Journeys, the road to creativity. This is George Soroy, and thank you so much for being here. And before we start on this episode, I want to note that this episode will be dealing with subjects of a frank and explicit nature. So this would be a good time for those of the younger listeners to maybe take a look at the episodes from August 2021 when I spoke with the different people involved in Transformers the movie. There are also some other ones that I think would definitely be more fitting for the younger age listeners. So if you wouldn't mind, just go ahead and hit pause on this episode and maybe revisit when you're 18 or older. And I'm looking forward to talking to you then. But as I said, this particular episode would definitely warrant some older ears to be listening to it. So I will wait for a moment. Okay, so if you're still here, that means that you are 18 and up, and you are really interested into listening to this story, which is exactly what I am. My guest this week, Mr. Vic Legina, is a perfect example of someone who found his way into trying to get his creative outlet going in one direction, and it wound up going in a very different direction. One that wound up being very lucrative, but at the same time wound up bringing on its own baggage. And after 20 years of working in the adult entertainment industry, Vic had decided to, in his own words, nuke the bridge as he crossed it, and he is gone on to actually put together a novel that is documenting his whole time in that field. And that novel, which is out now, is called Filthy, The Rise and Pending Death of Vic Legina. And it is an endeavor, as he says, 8.5 years in the making. And I'm really excited to not only hear about how the book came out, but also all the different events that led to the creation of said book. So this is going to be a very, very interesting conversation. I'm really excited to have Vic here. And it is my pleasure to introduce my week's guest, Mr. Vic Legina. Vic, how are you today?
Great. How are you? That was an incredible lead up. Good job.
Thank you. Thank you. That's something that I kind of pride myself on. Mm-hmm. And thank you once again to Podmatch for bringing us together. For those of you who are podcasters, definitely check out podmatch.com. And if you are looking to be a guest on podcasts, definitely go to podmatch.com, because you'll find a whole lot of resources on both sides, and it will do nothing but great things for you. And I'm saying that as someone who is not on Alex's payroll. So I'm very excited to be a part of this. I've been on that site for several years. It's led me to chatting with some really great and interesting people. And definitely Vic is on that list. So I'm really happy that he's here.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah, let's get into it.
Yeah. So let's start by talking a little bit about this book. The more I was hearing about that, the more I was just like, okay, I got to read this book, and it sounds pretty amazing. And it's called Filthy. So can you tell us a little bit about this?
Yeah, well, you're right. It started 8.5 years prior to releasing it. At that point in time, I had been in the porn industry for about 12 years, 13 years, and I felt that if I didn't put it down in some sort of tangible form, a lot would get lost in the ether over time. So I was on the cusp of ending another one of my dysfunctional relationships, and I sat down for literally 30 days, and I got us up to speed more like a journal. It really was a journal of sorts over that 1 month time period. And what had happened was I realized what a shit show my life had become. And some of the dark areas that I was slowly going to be wading into. So it was a wake up call for me to perhaps do better in life, make better choices, so that whenever this flaming Airbus was going to land, it was going to land in one piece. So anytime over the next 5 years, whenever we would have like a shutdown in the industry, which would happen from time to time if someone popped for HIV or otherwise, I would sit down and I would get us up to speed. Mm-hmm. And then the pandemic hit. And then I had more time. But then what also happened was my career with Brazzers ended during the first year of the pandemic for a variety of reasons. Mm-hmm. But once I decided to fully be retired from the industry, and I really had no desire to ever go back or be part of it, mm-hmm. I really decided that let's write a gritty, brutally honest, not castrated tome of my time in the industry, because I think there's a lot of performers who have written books or they hired ghostwriters to write their books. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to write something that was so true and so real that was like really the goal, especially for someone who was a producer and a director who had a front row seat with working for the company that would change the business for the worse, but change the business over the next several years that I was with them.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah. So because I didn't have to worry about upsetting anyone or saving my job or whatever, that's why I wrote it completely brutally honest. And I spent a lot of money on lawyers on this one because that was the thing. Like, I felt if I were to go to a traditional publisher, they would neuter me in yeah. a lot of ways in terms of what I want to say. And I felt there are some people I definitely throw under the bus. My previous employers, especially the third ownership, they are because they were, I can use bad words, right? I mean, we are talking yeah. about porn. Okay. Oh, yeah. Yeah. They were motherfuckers in every sense of the word. And I think and you read more up about MindGeek, who was the third iteration of the company that I worked for, all you have to do is Google MindGeek and you'll see all the bad press and all the bad dealings they had with Ooh. Over the time that they took over, which was around 2014-ish. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, look, it didn't end well. We'll put it that way. For someone who was as loyal and devoted to the company, they basically threw me away like a used porn baby wipe. Yeah. And I made them a lot of money, but you know what? Look, that's business. I'm not bitter about all of that. It was just more the fact that their arrogance and the fact that they felt that everyone was replaceable, which is true. I mean, and this is arrogant Canadians. That's really what they were. Mm-hmm. And there was no feeling that I had in terms of, oh, I'm worried about what people are think because they were good people. Like, I don't care. So that's, I think, the best kind of book when it is brutally honest. And of course, I talk a lot of shit about the industry, but I am the most brutal.
You're definitely not the first one to talk shit about the industry, though.
Right, right.
Like, I mean, I'm sure there are a lot of people that have no problem with being thrown under the bang bus, if you will.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, there was someone that had compared, like Jerry Butler was a performer from like the 80s.
Oh, yeah.
And he wrote a book that actually I read. His was interesting, and it was the perspective of a performer. I could tell, like, takes one to know one. He was doing a lot of cocaine because of his personality. But really, at the end of it all, it was from the perspective of a performer who was arguably a sex addict and a love addict and everything. So to me, it wasn't as in-depth as it could have been, whereas I'm talking about a lot of things. Specifically, like, my journey is a shit show, and those usually make for the best reads. Yeah. But I didn't really feel like, even though my life was a shit show and I made a lot of poor choices, especially when it came to relationships, that would be enough to sustain a reader. So what I wound up doing is when I decided, okay, we're going to release this book, I wrote a bunch of side topics that have nothing to do with me. It was more about the people that were in the industry that I knew that died, which is a very sobering element of it all, because That's the reality check. That's the reality check of why there's so much darkness in it, especially when you're dealing with people who literally decided that they wanted to escape from this world because of the darkness that was surrounding them.
Yeah.
So there was that. And then I write, like, for the people who want to know about the mechanics of the porn industry, there's 9 lessons of Vic Legina's School of Porn, where we talk about a lot of things like what to do when she's on her period, how to prep for anal. Is it squirt or is it pee? Hygiene. Oh, yeah. So I really get into all those. If there's ever ones where people are like, okay, dude, like you're on that line, it's those chapters. But I think it's very real because I don't think people understand how disgusting this business could be at times while you're on the production level.
Yeah. Yeah. Just like, and if, just knowing all the different types of subjects that are out there and all the different extremes that it can go in. It's definitely one of those things where just like, I can't even imagine like what it would be to just be working behind the scenes on it and have to just kind of look at it as like, oh, it's just another thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. And I did a check before I published the book on how many scenes did I produce and or direct over that 20-year career? Mm-hmm. And the answer was a lot. It was like 3,000. Like I bought one of those crowd clickers.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Now in my garage, there are 4 huge filing cabinets, each with envelopes in them that have the paperwork, the 2257 releases and paperwork of every scene I ever shot. So what I did was every time I saw like one scene, click, 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 at the end of all those clicks, 3,792.
Wow.
Right. Now, wow. I remember going through all this stuff, and sometimes a light would go off like, oh, I remember that day. But it was amazing to me of how much I forgot. And the reason why I forgot those is because that day went well.
Mm.
There were no problems. It was smooth. Everyone showed up. We got the job done. But when you what you remember is when things go massively sideways.
Mm. Yeah.
And that can mean a lot of things. It can mean, oh, that girl was pilled out. We had to stop the shoot. Or that girl, yeah, the dude just couldn't stay hard the entire time. And that was a real time in the trench. Or, oh, yeah, that one, she just really did not have any kind of etiquette whatsoever when it came to prepping for anal. And these are the days that you remember. The craziest ones we always did was, and this is the prologue and the epilogue, we used to do live shows, live orgies. Great. Yeah. One of which was like about 50 yards that way by my pool. Mm-hmm. And that is the prologue, which is, yeah, we're like, if you're on board on this filthy train, we're going to get you dirty quick. And like, I really hit people in the face with a 2x4 when it comes to the intro of the book. That's how I know if someone, I got them or not. But it's not meant to be gross. It's just meant to be true. And I have a witty way of words that can say something without being too heavy-headed to be like, okay, I can't deal with it. Very few people were like, yeah, I couldn't get through it because it was just too gross. They were the people who couldn't get through it was just becoming too dark for them at times. Mm. And I get it. But I think that's important to showcase that, not only with the people who were in the industry, but for me personally. Because that really puts the exclamation mark at the end of the sentence.
Oh my, yeah. And yeah, just it sounds like a perfect way to just say like, okay, like you've gone through this whole scene. It's just like, you're either in or you're out.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's very intense. That's a hell of a way to really kind of get things started. And I'm intrigued. I'm definitely intrigued I'm definitely looking forward to reading this and really getting into it.
Do you prefer reading or do you prefer audiobooks?
I am good. I'm good either way. Like I was away from reading for a while just because except for when I'm doing audiobooks myself. Mm-hmm.
Right.
And so I've done my share of reading there. I've done some reading out loud and then I've also done a lot of listening to audiobooks. So it can go. I'm good with getting it however I can get it. So.
Yeah, no, for sure. The reason why I ask is I like physical books too. So I made sure that the physical product is worth the consumer's dollar. I didn't just slap together just this book. I mean, you can, we're doing just audio, but the you look at the cover, the front cover, back cover, the whole inside of it. I mean, I put money and funds behind this because I wanted to release a product that I would be proud of that wasn't shit, you know? But that's not to take anything away from the audiobook. The audiobook, in my opinion, especially for people who are lacking on time to sit down and actually read a physical book, the audio is the way to go because not only, I mean, I'm reading it and I narrated that and put this thing together, 40 days of recording, 50 days of editing, and I went deep in it on creating something that just reflected my type of like offbeat weirdness. Like I'm really drawn to that kind of element. And when I was pulling a lot of the material that I was recreating and writing about, I then was like, well, why don't I just insert a lot of these sound bites into the audiobook? Yeah. So we've got a lot of that as well. So I never listened to an audiobook before. I was always a reader. So I wanted to be sure that mine was completely unique. So if you drive a lot, if you travel a lot, I say get the audiobook because it'll be fun. And if you're really adventurous, let me do a read-along. Take the book and let me read it to you because that's another good way too.
Yeah, why not? It sounds like a blast, and definitely not something to listen to with the kids in the car.
Exactly. Yeah, that is the truth. I wouldn't do that. I would strongly suggest keep your AirPods in and keep the volume at a reasonable level. That's my suggestion.
That's definitely what you want to do.
Like the one a set of ladies who listened to it, they're like, dude, it was like an acid trip. And I go, that was kind of what I was going for there. So thank you.
Awesome. Yeah. Awesome. But this book would not be where it is if you didn't go through the journey yourself. So one of the things that I love to hear about is what I call the road to creativity. And that's that moment when you experience something or see something, read something, and it just makes you want to be a part of that industry. Now, obviously, you didn't mean to jump, didn't say like, oh, when I grow up, I want to be in porn, but I want to be involved in film, correct? Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yeah. And you're absolutely right. There is that, I guess, that woo-saw moment when you're growing up of this, I want to be part of. Well, for me, that was like, I wasn't even 7 years old yet. And Empire Strikes Back is released. Oh, nice. And I'm like, wow, I can't believe I'm seeing this. Like someone made this and they created it. And that just continued. I became more into television shows, movies. I mean, Back to the Future in 1985 was another one where I'm like, I just love this. And I love going to the movies. It was such a thing. And it still is, especially me and my girlfriend. We love catching stuff. And the more weird and offbeat that it is, the better. And so that never left me. Yeah. So the trick was I was a decent student. I grew up outside of Philadelphia. So go Eagles. We'll go there.
As a Giants fan, like that's one of the things that I've been saying is just like, I'm not an Eagles fan by any stretch of the imagination, but it is really cool to see that every team in our division has more than one Lombardi trophy.
And yeah. That says something.
That's pretty damn cool. Like that.
Yeah.
I want to talk about establishing dominance.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. You're right there.
Not bad at all.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'll leave my Saquon Barkley jokes out of this for now. We'll stay on topic here.
I made my peace with it and I cheered for the guy. I'm glad that he's got his ring.
Yeah. He seems like a really good dude. He really does. But okay. Going back to it. So growing outside of Philadelphia, kind of an awkward kid. I think we're all pretty awkward usually growing up. Me a little bit more because I was the only Jewish kid in my class and I caught a lot of shit for that. And I just was not really comfortable in my skin suit. So perhaps video games and movies and TV was a good escape for me. And I was a decent student, ABs. You got Jewish parents. They're always like, you need to get good grades so you can get into college, right? Yep. Which I don't even know if I would tell that to my kid these days because from someone who had 6 years of higher education, and I really see it as kind of a waste of time. But to start all that, after I graduated, I went to Syracuse University, and I was undeclared going in. But they have a really good communication school. So I was like, let's do it. And then I got in, and I majored in TV and film production. And I really enjoyed it. It was at that point, being so fresh and young, I was very intrigued by the whole production process. But over time, that will wane, and it certainly did for me. But at the time, this is what I want to do. And after freezing at Syracuse, I'm like, I'm done with cold weather. I'm going to Miami. And then I got a job working for a corporate and commercial production company. Started as a production assistant, lugging stuff, tripods, cameras, all of that. I mean, that's really how you start in production. But you can do that without going to college. That's the thing. That's my point. Like, if you get yourself on a set, you don't need all this higher education. But eventually, I would elevate myself to be an editor, to be a producer, while also getting my master's at University of Miami, and then eventually teaching. I was a college professor. This porn producer was a college professor. Like, that's how, like, Just so weird the world is at times.
Well, you kind of followed in the footsteps of Wes Craven too, because he was a college professor as well.
Wow,
and it was just like you either go for your PhD or you quit, and he quit. And
yeah,
went to getting into movies.
Yeah, well, he did better than I did, at least from I guess not. He didn't have to shoot porn. Well, I guess is really what he did, unless he did. He did, huh?
He did. He started out like a little bit, went into it under a different name, of course.
Sure.
But The Last House on the Left was originally conceived as a porno.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Go Wes Craven. Rest in peace, buddy.
Thank God it didn't become that. But
right.
Yeah. What it was, but
yeah.
Of what that movie was, but yeah.
You know. Yeah. So I'm in Miami, and it's okay. Miami's fun for that age, but I really wanted to make TV shows and movies. Nice. So at around the time that the millennium hit was when I was in Jamaica doing another video for one of the all-inclusive resorts down there. Mm-hmm. And I meet this model that we brought down, and she's deciding she wants to go to LA. And of course, if a pretty girl asks, hey, suggest, like, why don't you come to LA? You're going to say yes. And so that's how this whole crazy train started. For those who have not lived in LA, I'll just tell you this. It's not a cheap town to live in. It's very competitive. There's a very weird energy about it. The traffic sucks. So it's hard. And for me, who was like a college professor and I was producing, the only jobs that I was able to find that were available were jobs that were like assistants or interns. Mm-hmm. And at that time, I think I was 27 years old, and my ego would not allow me to take a job because I was better than that. So what was happening was I was submitting all of my, and they were shitty scripts. They weren't really good. I can say that now, but I was submitting all of these, funding everything on credit cards, occasionally going back to Florida to work a little bit. But yeah, I mean, it was a struggle. There was times when me and my girlfriend, who were living in a shitty studio apartment in West Hollywood, were just eating eggs. Like, that's what LA was for us. And then it really got sidetracked when she decided that she no longer wanted to be working as a SAG extra. She wanted to be Feminem. She wanted to be the first white female rapper.
And best name ever.
Yeah. 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 And I thought it was the greatest idea. And this was going to be the one that's going to make us rich and famous and everything else. Mm-hmm. Like, boy, was I like pussy drunk. Like, I think that's the only way you could describe that.
And you can say that here. It's okay.
Yeah. So really we got her a demo. We got her with some producers. I, of course, funded this entire endeavor on my credit card because, hey, we're going to be rich. Like, it's, don't worry. It's an investment. That's what I kept telling myself. And looking at it several years removed, decades removed, really, the one thing I realized about her is even though she had the looks and she had the story, because she had a lot of trauma growing up, and she was somewhat competent on the microphone, looking at her, you just look at her, you're like, I don't know why, but I can't stand this person. Like, I just don't like her. I can't be a fan. And that was apparent to me and apparently everyone else. I don't know. Maybe it was the aura that she gave off, because she kind of had this feeling that she was deserving of more because of what she grew up with. And that's why I think that relationship was so bad, is because it was just not only hard financially, but she just wasn't a very evolved person, and eventually got comfortable doing nothing. really, which was me just, she's obsessing about her music career, doing bong rips on our futon because we couldn't even afford a couch. And I'm in LA, I start selling cameras, and it was just getting rough. But then one day I answer this ad on adultstaffing.com, which is this young Mexican kid who had a speech impediment. It was like a stutter. He said, I want to make a porn movie and I need a director. And I said, hey, bud, I can help you. And he copped my bullshit story and he said, okay, let's do this. And that led to my first day ever on a porn set that was in April of 2002. And that's how this whole journey started.
Wow. So what was it like just kind of walking into that room and seeing like, okay, so is this going to be the next direction of my life? Is this going to be like the next step here? Or is it just something like, oh, let's just go ahead and get this over with and then I can move on to something else?
Yeah. Yeah. It was like, let me get that $500 because I really need it because I got credit card bills to pay. Yeah. That was really the reason. But it started off kind of gross because he's no longer alive, but there was an agent named Jim South. And we were in his office in the valley, and he's just smoking cigarettes, and it's just smoke billowing everywhere. And I'm not a smoker, and I'm just like, ugh, yeah. It's going to be all over my clothes and my hair. Blah. But then on top of it all, which made it even fucking more weird, was that he had Polaroids everywhere of his models. Polaroids. Oh, this is 2002. The internet exists. Digital cameras exist. Yet this guy has Polaroids. So we're going through his Polaroids.
At all.
it's just like, well, really? Yeah. So we picked our five models and we put together a shoot. Now, the one day that where it all started, it was four shoots we got done that day in a valley, in a condo in the San Fernando Valley. And one of the last shoots we did that day, the last shoot actually was with Ron Jeremy. Like,
oh boy.
That was my first day of porn ever. Wow. And I have memories from that will never go away, particularly when he was eating cold pizza naked after the shoot, or the fact that like he told the woman to count down from 20. And once he hit one, blah, blah, I'm like, wow, I can't believe I'm witnessing this. So in some ways it was just like, wow. And then we had one guy, Nick Manning. He was an asshole. He was the one who couldn't keep his dick hard, yelling at everyone. And I was like, okay, so really that first day was like, it ran the gamut of the things that I would encounter. But the grossest part of it was when someone started smoking crack. Cause I smelled it. It smelled like a burnt socket. And I walk by a room and I see these two, what looked like crack smokers smoking their crack. And I was like that was, I guess, what sent it over to the fact of like, this is gross and filthy, which is why I think I named my book Filthy. But that was how I felt. Like I felt when I came home that day, I really needed to shower and bathe that filth off of me. Mm-hmm. But that day started a whole chain reaction of meeting other people. And them needing work, whether it was editing or we want to put this shoot together. And I was doing all this stuff in LA, but it just wasn't really clicking as much. So because I was just under so much financial stress and I knew I had a definite job back in Miami, we pack up my jalopy of a Grand Cherokee that's falling apart and the engine is smoking, and we make our way back to South Florida. And with all of that, I'd work in corporate again, but the porn snowball had already started and I knew where to chase the leads for porn, which was on a website called gofuckyourself.com. And they would post their needs for content. I would put bids in. I would underbid everyone. I would say, I will edit, I will encode. And lo and behold, the job started coming in. And unlike corporate world where you work a day and you might get paid as a freelancer, like 30, 60 days down the road, porn, you literally got paid before the first frame of video was shot. So to me, it was like, it makes sense which way to go because I have debt and all that stuff. So me and the girlfriend were trying to work it all out, but she still was smoking bong rips on my futon and not working. And that was just getting more and more stressed. And I wasn't really making much of a dent. in my credit card debt. And then she just became like so disgusted with me because I was such a bastard to live with because I viewed her as a leech. She leaves, right? She leaves me. Mm-hmm. And that was after 4.5 years. And I think I was hanging on because I was waiting for my payday for her being a white female rapper, right? But that just wasn't happening. So she took off. And I made a promise to myself that within 1 year, I was going to be out of debt. And January comes around and I have a goal. I make that in February, March. And I'm like, holy shit, this gray cloud that was over me for the last 4.5 years is no longer there. Like I saw a light at the end of the tunnel. And by October, 2 months before I was my goal of getting out of debt. That's when I was out of debt. And then I have this boom in business where I have the guys who they weren't called Brazzers yet. But they were getting to that point. And these dudes were keeping me busy. And during that grinding phase is when that porn snowball started growing bigger and bigger, where I had a decision. Okay, I'm out of debt, right? That was the goal. Do I go back to being straight and narrow, or do we see what's behind door number two? And there was a tickle in my belly. That's the only way I could describe it, where I was like, there's something about this that you need to see how far you can take it. Mm-hmm. And if it fails, you always have yourself. Like, that's what I always believed in, that I knew even if my back was against the wall, I could work my way out of anything. Mm-hmm. And it served me well over the years. And sometimes we call it, in Yiddish, it's called chutzpah. It's guts. You got to have some guts. You got to have some balls. If you're feeling a tickling in your plums, well, dude, just go for it. And that was the line of thinking. Now, that line of thinking wasn't like in hindsight, I probably could have slowed my roll a little bit, but I was like at warp speed going to my destination, which is where is this crazy porn story going to go? And listen, if I didn't make that decision, then who knows if I would have had such a colorful existence? Who knows if I would have gotten to be able to fill up a book with my insane stories of real things that I experienced? So I'm not grateful nor ashamed of the journey, but I recognize the journey for what it was and why I felt like I had to share it with the world.
Kind of like a means to an end, it did what it was supposed to do. It got you out of debt, and it also provided you the chance to make a comfortable living.
Yeah,
doing things that, like, while the subject matter may not have been what you were originally thinking of doing, at least you could be in that sort of field, in a sort of field like creating something, putting something to film.
Yes,
and so. While you were doing those, I mean, they're all just like little, like 20-minute, 30-minute scenes, right?
Yeah, it started out in the beginning, like we were doing, and the reason why I bought like such a big house that I had no business buying, nor should have been able to buy, but they were giving mortgages away back then. And that's kind of part of the story, because when the housing market in Vegas exploded 2 years later, that's where I was like, thank God there's a porn industry, because it's keeping all of this afloat.
Yeah.
But in the beginning, it was just those gonzo scenes where, like, Brazzers in the beginning, what they were known for were the big boobs, the big butts. It wasn't rocket science. The original owners knew that if we just focus on big tits, we are going to convert and we're going to make a lot of money. And it was not flawed thinking at all, because that's how Brazzers started. So I was doing all of the ones where, like, and thank God, like, these scenes probably are very hard to find. But the ones where, like, the guy who's running the camera is, like, talking and, like the annoying motherfucker that you're telling to shut up while you're trying to jerk off, like that guy. Like, I had to be that guy, and I hated it. I fucking hated it, because, I didn't want to be part of this process. I didn't want to have to put on a performance. I was a production dude, so let me stay in that lane. But they're like, no, Vic, you got to talk to her. You got to do this and that. I'm like, oh, yeah, rub the fucking oil all over your boobs. And I sound so, like, uncomfortable about it, because, like, that's not me at all. Yeah. But that's what we were doing. And then This is when they really got smart. They were like, Naughty America at the time was doing like Naughty Office or My Friend's Hot Mom or things of these scenarios, which were, you could say that they were scripted, but I could just tell it was two performers like bullshitting and the guy trying to get it all in one take. Like, okay, say this, and this is the scenario, and just make it up as you go. Boom, record. And that's what Naughty America was doing. But Brazzers wanted to do it better and incorporate what else? Big tits. So the first one start is Big Tits at Work. And I'm shooting like stuff all around my house, which is Big Tits at Work. And I got to tell you, man, like those first 6 months of me working here when I first got to Vegas and I'm grinding two shoots a day and I'm the one running pictures, video, mopping up the baby oil in the room you see back there, like doing all this stuff because that's what it was all part of, baby oil and everything else. Yeah. After Big Tits at Work launched, and I was no longer having to employ the $200 a scene mopes that had the small dicks and really couldn't keep them hard. Now they're like, what do you need, Vic? Like that was after Big Tits at Work launched. It was the game changer. And I said, give me better dicks to work with. It sounds so hilarious to say it, but that was it. Like I was tired of like a dude who couldn't keep his dick hard. And I have to cut. I'm sitting there with my camera in my hands. And I'm debating about like all the wrong choices I've made in life. And he's in the corner furiously jerking it. And I'm staring like awkwardly at the female performer who sometimes they would help the guy to get him hard, but it's not in their job description. So a lot of times they're like, yeah, he's going to work this one out on his own. And you're trying not to make any noise because you want the dude to have a hard on, right?
Right.
But you're sitting looking at each other and you're like, another day. Yeah. It's like, this is when you earn your money. And there were plenty of those days, but once their Big Tits at Work started launching and they could start giving me money for stuff, that's when it was like, okay, you could cue the Peter Gabriel song Big Time going and have a whole like this montage of like a things going well and the things getting bigger. And that's really what it was in the beginning. And the first ownership, they were called Mansef. I liked those dudes. They were like these young go-getters, frat bros from like Canada who went to Concordia University. And they appreciated me and they took care of me and they gave me bonuses. And that was the time I could look back. I was saying, I'm part of this thing that's called Brazzers and it's shaking up the entire porn industry. Like it was pretty exciting, I would say, in a lot of ways, even though taxing on the body and on the mind, you're just kind of like, well, it's like kind of electric and it was fun, but there was a lot of transitions over the years and different ownerships and which with each owner, different things happened and different kind of baggage and different kind of stressors and different directions the industry went overall.
Yeah. And then once it got to that, did you start to kind of feel like maybe it was time to plot an exit strategy or was at that time, was the money just still?
No, the money was still too good. And I still needed the industry from a financial standpoint because of getting my house and the mortgages like all wrapped up. Like, I mean, a lot of it was throwing money to my house. Now, here's the good news about all of that. It all is worth it because I still have a very small mortgage, right? But the home prices in Vegas have exploded so much and it's such a destination that I have a lot of equity in this house now that I happen to love. So in that ways, I've got wealth there that wasn't just trying to save yourself from bankruptcy. It was, oh, wow, that the hard work actually paid off and it's good. You've got something to show for it.
Right.
But then it was like, man, if I don't stay on this, I am facing implosion, financial implosion. So it kept me going and it was beneficial. Because I did make a lot of snap judgments when it came to doing the porn industry and getting this house and doing all that. But it went in some different directions, man. And to go back to your original point, every day I was shooting a short film. That's the way I looked at it. And all of the things that I learned from being a producer and an editor, I knew how to shoot to make my scenes really good for an editor to just cut it up real quick. And like I delivered, I was their guy that like constantly delivered. And because of it, they kept me very busy through the years.
Nice. So that's where that that training came from, really just kind of lent itself to getting you in a position where you were looked at as an asset.
Yeah, like being he's such an awesome pornographer. He's like I mean, it's so cheesy to say that, but like, yeah. Cream did rise to the top. And if you were a very competent individual and you always delivered, and more importantly, you stayed on budget, which is that's business and that's production as well. Like everything that I learned, I did apply towards the industry and how I ran my show, and it served me very well for a very long time because. I don't know what it was, but something about porn or production in general, I was able to manage that chaos very effectively mm-hmm. without it turning into, we're not going to get the day and we're not going to have any major incidences where people are going to freak out. Like those live shows that I talk about, especially the one in the epilogue. Yeah. I mean, we're talking pure insanity, live sex, like that is hot, and you have to start at a certain point. And you're managing sometimes six mm-hmm. porn stars to yeah. get them to like start, right? Because they're notoriously late for everything. And I had to be like the crazy train conductor of all this stuff. But mm-hmm. whatever it was, and when you start getting into second ownership and things getting more busy and me having a couple more bad, toxic, dysfunctional relationships, that's when I started going a little darker myself. Which was then taking the wrong drugs. Like there are right drugs and there are wrong drugs. The wrong drugs that I would say for me was cocaine. And I started doing that. And I did it for a couple of reasons, but mainly it was because of how busy we were. Right. Most people now take Adderall, right? Which is, that's amphetamine. Okay. But for me, my choice, oddly enough, was cocaine. And it kept me busy and focused on the chaos. Mm-hmm. While numbing myself simultaneously from all the darkness that was surrounding me that I was somewhat oblivious to.
Wow.
Yeah, I became cognizant of that when I was writing the book and I was recapping all of the rest in porns, the in memoriams.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you read their obituary and you're like, oh my God, I had no idea that they were in so much pain. And that's when I realized, yeah, dude, you were drinking too much and doing too much coke because you were just really trying to shield yourself from all of this negative energy penetrating your vessel, essentially. Yeah.
Yeah. So sounds like you were really just kind of like trying to build up that armor.
Yes. Yeah. You had to, because like, look, the whole thing is what we were doing was completely legal mm-hmm. and everything was consensual. And yeah. there were a lot of hurdles that someone would have to get over before they got across my desk and we were going to shoot a scene. There's like a vetting process because you're dealing with something that's very delicate mm-hmm. and the performer's putting themselves in a very vulnerable position. And in order to get things done well, you have to keep them comfortable. So it has to be viewed as a safe space. Yeah. And that's why I never really had a problem with what I was doing, because we were all there to make the money to get us where we wanted to be. And we were doing it in a way that was professional and it was respectful and everything else. So I was okay with it as a human, because that was the first thing I said when I got into this business. Like, dude, yeah. if you do this, that's fine, but don't lose your soul. And it was like a mandate. Now, I'll tell you, it got dark at times for sure. And I definitely had probably more fun than I should have been from a deviant sense. Right. For sure. And I don't shy away from all that stuff at all, because for me, I was trying to date and I was dating very unsuccessfully. So I decided, okay, well, spend your time with those within the industry when the vibe is right. But you're inviting a energy with that as well, even into your safe personal space. Mm-hmm. So it was, I guess that was the toughest go, because you have a choice. Do I want to be lonely or do I not want to be lonely and take on a questionable relationship, which is what I did. And I knew the repercussions of choosing poorly was,
yeah.
Or do you just become comfortable being alone and having casual encounters with those within your business? And that's what it was. But that too is a balance, because you're bringing in energies and trauma, and like sometimes there's some trauma dumping that you're getting from those you're hanging with, and it can be dark as well, even in your comfort zone.
Absolutely. And with all of that darkness potentially just kind of all around you, there had to have been like some bright spots in there too. There had to have been like some people that you were working with that you were just like, oh, they're going to be on the set. Awesome. All right. I really like working with them. Were there any like that you had some good vibes with?
Certainly. You have ones that are like, okay, she's cool. I'm going to have a good day. And we know we're going to be smiling, laughing. It's going to be light. It's not going to be a day. Like, you love those. But for every one of those, there was like three others. And that's the trend just seemed to be going in that direction where some days you just knew it was going to be mechanical, it was going to be work. Some days you're like, we have to like pull up our bootstraps because we are going to war on this one because, it could be like that at times, especially with some of the personalities that you're inviting in. And it seemed like the bigger the train wreck, the bigger the porn star or the bigger amount of baggage. And I don't see how that's any different really from a diva in the regular movie industry. They have a certain popularity, therefore they seem to have this entitlement to act a certain way or be late or be on their phone all the time or all of that. I mean, you had all of those as well. Where I found my bright spots with my dogs, first and foremost, because they were always around me. Then I had like my group of friends that were not in the porn industry, because I didn't really make a lot of friends in the porn industry because, to be quite honest, they just weren't my people. Like, I remember being in porn functions and just feeling like that awkward kid that I was back in middle school. Like, I don't have anything in common with them. And even those that I was like intimate with, there was usually like, okay, is this, it sounds terrible saying it, but how many hours can I hang out with this person? 2 hours? Am I cool with them staying the night? Like, you have to classify some people that you're having just physical relationship with and deciding how much after are you willing to accept? Like, and that's how I viewed everything. So they really weren't my people. Whereas once I realized, and this was after I was writing the book and started it and realizing you can have a pivot here of going dark or staying in the light. And a lot of staying in the light was going to music festivals and meeting like these cool, sparkly, shiny, beautiful people that are going to music festivals that hug you when they see you. And there's just like a warmth of energy. So anytime that I would be feeling like I'm having too much of porn, I got to go hit a music festival and I got to be around that energy. And once I came back, I'm like, I am ready to deliver amazing porn to the masses.
And when you're in this industry where you basically just sounds like what you were doing was just kind of keeping everyone around you at arm's length, your arms can get tired.
Yeah. Yeah. But that's really what it was. It was finding the bright spots to keep you out of the darkness. I mean, imagine a dude, he's on a tightrope. One side is like fiery hell. And the other side, well, you don't want to fall there either. You don't want to fall either way. But that was me for a good many years. And to be honest with you, we all know that cocaine now, you have to test it. You have to make sure there's no fentanyl in it. Like, there, if I continued on this path, very likely I would have died from an accidental overdose or my heart exploding, even though I don't think that's really was my concern because I take care of myself. But that's why when COVID hit and the business was changing and I was up to my wit's end, especially with Third Ownership, MindGeek, my crew, they always found something to complain about. Like, they were exhausting. And then you'd have to deal with some of these performers that we're talking at that point young, like 22 years old. And there was something very unique going on, which was that those I found born like after 96, 97, and they were starting to show up in my set, there was this inability to be able to communicate. Now, when you're dealing with consensual sex on camera, communication is the most important thing. Yeah. And you also are an adult on an adult production. So there were always words and things we were always looking out for during a scene. If you heard no, if you heard stop, if you heard cut. But you also wanted to be sure that everyone knew their boundaries. Like, if a girl wanted to be choked, there were rules. She has to ask to be choked, and she has to look like she's enjoying it. So I always said, hey, if you want to be choked, these are the rules, but I mean, are you into it? They're like, yeah, I love it. Okay, cool. Well, let's have fun. But that's, these are the conversations we would have. Yeah. But with the younger crop that was coming in, there was this thing where they were not calling cut. And then they would say something after the fact, like days, sometimes years, about how something was, a line was crossed. And you're like, didn't hear anything, didn't see anything. Now, mind you, I mean, I'm looking at a viewfinder. I'm looking at focus. I'm looking at exposure. But I'm waiting to hear cut, stop, no, any of that. Right. And what was happening was these younger performers were saying, I didn't know if I could call it. Some of which were veterans that were saying it, which didn't make sense. Or the veterans would say, I was trying to tell you with my eyes.
That can't be enough.
Right. It can't. But that's what was being said. Or I just wanted to power through to get it over with. Wow. Okay. And you're like, but, and then you have an exit interview and you're asking the questions. Were you okay? Were you treated okay? Were you asked to do anything you didn't want to do? And you never had, no, like I was over the line. Like you had like these positive exit interviews. So when you started getting calls after the fact, you're like, I don't know. And that's where I started to feel like porn was becoming a slippery slope.
Hmm.
Or maybe I was just getting older and the younger generation was like a father not being able to communicate with his daughter, that kind of breakdown in communication.
Yeah.
And perhaps I was aging out. I was getting long in the porn tooth. So, yeah. I mean, that's kind of where I think all of this was heading in a lot of ways. And so you factor all of that with the fact that the business was changing because OnlyFans was taking over. Mm-hmm. It was like, it became clear as day. It's like, just, you're still alive. You have your money. You have a good plan. Land the boat, land the plane when you can. Yeah. And that's really what happened. And that's where I am. And that was in early of 2022. Mm-hmm. Where I sold the studio, which I had bought, that I didn't tell anyone that I was buying, that was being rented to the company for 5 years, and just sold that for double what I paid. Right. And didn't get married, didn't have kids, so I was able to leapfrog into retirement if I live smartly. Let's just put that caveat on it. But but this whole porn journey was getting yourself in a good situation, and my overhead is low. So, yeah, I can afford to just chill now. And I'm really enjoying what I worked for those like 20 years, because like I have battle scars, so it's good. I have something to show for it.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're definitely one of the lucky ones there, because they're just like you said, that there are so many different people that got into this industry and unfortunately never made it out. And there are a lot of others that were able to kind of like get out on their own terms. So it's good to hear that you were able to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think the truth is that I always had an appreciation for a performer that was treating themselves like a brand and a business, but the scales got balanced out with the advent of OnlyFans and FanCentro and all of these platforms, where the wealth was then being distributed back to them. And now they can. But for a while there, when you're on just like waiting to work in the studio porn side of things and getting a booking there, they're supplementing with escorting. They're supplementing with maybe webcamming. Now they don't have to really do that unless they want to. Yeah. So I can understand why now, health-wise, mental health-wise, it's better for performers because they have their OnlyFans and they can kind of go at their own pace.
And assume control over everything.
Yes. 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 Yeah, you didn't have these scumbag agents that were trying to keep their talent poor because it kept them in line and kept them working so they can turn them out. Like, that was the business. So that's why there was such a correlation of those who decided to end it. Because if I'm feeling the darkness and I'm doing none of that except for shooting it, you can only imagine what they were feeling.
Yeah. And it sounds kind of like the way that it was back in the day was very similar to what Hollywood itself was like back in the studio days.
Yeah.
Just kind of grinding their talent down to nothing.
Yep.
So I'm glad to hear that things have gotten in a position where it's much more advantageous to the talent and people like yourself and others were able to kind of get out of it on their own terms, or at least like make it into something that works for them. And it sounds like you were able to do that. And that's terrific.
Yeah. I was able to do it just because I was grinding, but yeah. With performers now, they do have this. And I guess really the tell would be, as morbid as this sounds, is the death count year after year. Now, 2024 did not start off well, where you had Jesse Jane overdosing next to her partner in Oklahoma somewhere. Oh. And that was the first one. Yeah. And then the next one was Cagney Lynn Carter. She was a performer. Now, she was probably in her mid to late 30s and came from that system that we just talked about. Yeah. And she decided to put a shotgun in her mouth. And that was in early 2024. Now, I keep an ear out for this sort of stuff. And because I really think the porn industry does a terrible job of when someone dies within the industry, rather than kind of give a perspective of the whys of it and the humanity of why they were in pain, which would be the teachable moments of all that. They decide to talk about the fluff. And the people who talk about them talk about their experiences about them and make it more about them instead of making it about the person. And it's horseshit. And I call it out. I'm like, I think you have to realize that there's a problem here with mental health, and perhaps you need to address that.
Yeah.
So I get a little vocal on Twitter a little bit of that. And I don't know now. I think if in the future, especially that you see less death within the porn industry, that means perhaps the system they have now is working out. And it is. So we have to see.
Well, let's hope that the things continue to kind of go on that, I would say, like uphill kind of vibe to it. Cause it does sound like things have kind of mellowed out.
Yeah.
You would say.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it is. And look, the porn industry on the corporate side, on the studio side, I think all of that needs to be severely retooled. Like, I was part of and I saw the porn monopoly coming together.
Yeah.
But there's a reason why we don't have monopolies in this country. They get broken up because of antitrust laws. Now, the company that owns everything is Canadian, with headquarters or offices around the world. So I don't know how you would break that up, but it really needs to be in order for, I think, the industry to have a major correction, because I think if you've got one entity that has so much power, it then becomes something that is hard to fix.
And normally it's around this time when I would say that someone were to want to follow in someone's footsteps, then what would be like something that you would suggest to them? In this case, it would definitely be something very different. So I would say there's someone who wants to get into a creative outlet, but is not exactly sure how to do that. But then all of a sudden there's a situation that comes in where an opportunity presents itself that they wouldn't have expected or they wouldn't have really wanted. What's something that you would suggest to them if they were in that situation?
I think really it comes down to, if you're going to work, if you're going to take a job, do the job to the best of your ability, whether you want to be there or not. That was what was instilled on me. That is what I wish to instill on the younger generations. Things I understand do come quickly for some, but there is the importance of putting the work in, putting the time in, putting the dedication, being good at what you do, honing your craft, even if it's not where you want to be, because you need to do that in order to get anywhere. Otherwise, you're going to be stuck kind of in one place where perhaps this is what you're going to be doing for your entire life, is just working, living hand to mouth. If you want to get ahead, put the work in, and you do have to take some risks.
Absolutely. And where can my listeners find you on social media?
Social media, X and Instagram. I am at Vic Legina. And what I tell people is, go to my website, viclegina.com. Mm-hmm. And if you're looking to either get the book, whether print or Kindle or audio, the links to get to them are all there. But I guess going back to the creative side of things, and I think I'm so happy that I did this, which was, so over the course of my career, I had two studios. One was a 16,000 square foot monstrosity where I had two, sometimes three directors going on at once and outputting like literally 25 to 30 shoots a month for Brazzers. Mm-hmm. And I had that for 6 years, but I leased it. But when the third ownership came in and they wanted to start making things a little more cost efficient, they told me I needed to downsize. This goes back to the taking big swings, taking some risk. I decided, I was like, well, if I own this building, if I can figure out a way to buy it, this is going to be a way for me to get the retirement cheese when I need to get out. Like, this is when the porn musical chairs are ending. What is the plan going to be? Yeah. And I figure if I've got this dope studio that is mine under full control, there will be options no matter what. So when we got into that second one, that was when the best stuff that I ever shot for Brazzers came out of that studio, the last 5 years of what I worked for them. But there was a time for me when it was all over, when porn was done, when I was like, I'm going to get a tenant now, I'm going to be a landlord, and then I'm going to sell the building. I figured, what? I've had two studios, and all I shot were movies that ended with a facial. And shouldn't I shoot something that is creative, that sparks the creative spirit? Nice. Because otherwise it would be a travesty. So that's what I did. And I wrote this script. It was about 70 pages long. It was supposed to be like 6 days of a pornographer where you go in every day, different things happen, which all were based on true stories of things that happened. Mm-hmm. And I had the money to do it, and I got James Duval. Do you know who he is?
James Duval. Yeah.
Hollywood actor, right? Mm-hmm. Well, two people who were in my orbit suggested him. They didn't know each other, but they both suggested this dude. So I go, all right, let's have a FaceTime with him. And I got on a FaceTime and I said, hey, did you read the script? He's like, yeah, man. He's like, I love it. I was like, so do you want to play Vic Legina? And he's like, I can't wait to play Vic Legina. And so I put together this shoot for like 30 grand using my studio. And we created this. This was supposed to be a movie, but that part stalled. It's to be decided if I ever go back to it. But while I was waiting on this editor to deliver this cut, I decided, like, okay, let me cut like a really good trailer for the book. Mm-hmm. And that is what is on VicLegina.com right now. We mined all of the gold from the trailer and put together, and it really sums up what the book is, what it's like to be in the insanity of the porn industry. And that was like me putting together everything that I've done over my career to make something that was like really cool and really fun and something I'm proud of. That and the book Filthy. So, nice. Yeah,
that is fabulous. And that in itself right there is a perfect encapsulation of this whole conversation, because you wanted to get as much of yourself out there as possible, like when it comes to like using the resources that were there. Mm-hmm. And you were able to create something that you yourself felt proud of.
Yes.
And that's something that I feel like that's something that I really hope that all of my listeners really take to heart, because a combination of what you had said just here and also what you said before are the main things that they really need to take with them. Do whatever job that is there to the best of your ability. But at the same time, at the end of the day, you have to have something that you're going to be proud of and that you can't lose your soul while you're doing it. So by all means, all of you out there, like if whatever kind of stories you're working on, whatever kind of creative journey you are on, whatever you can do to get these jobs done, do them to the best of your ability. Make sure there's something that you can be proud of. And at the end of the day, don't lose your soul. And just remember, in these very crazy times, we need your voices. We need your stories now more than ever. So for Vic Legina, this is George Soroy saying to all of you, ever upward. And I will see you next week.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of Excelsior Journeys. I hope it was both inspiring and entertaining. Special thanks to Zach Comtois for providing new music for the intro and outro. please take a moment to leave a rate and review on Apple Podcasts. And if you enjoy the show, please share it with your friends and subscribe to your platform of choice by going to hesgotit.com/podcasts. While there, you can also fill out the application to be a guest, inquire about sponsorship opportunities, and click on the Buy Me a Coffee link if you wish to give your support to the show. All interaction is very much appreciated. If you have a question, comment, or suggestion for the show, please direct it to George@hesgotit.com.